Hoe geef je richting aan verandering? Hoe maak je impact met visie, leiderschap en innovatie? Je hoort het op het podcastkanaal New Business Radio. Listen today, lead tomorrow. Hier vind je al onze programma's voor business shapers. Met gesprekken met leiders, ondernemers en vernieuwers die hun organisatie klaarmaken voor de volgende sprong. Check je favoriete podcastplatform en abonneer je op New Business Radio. Listen today, lead tomorrow. Hoe ontketen je de kracht van mensen in organisaties? PeoplePower brengt je de laatste wetenschappelijke inzichten en praktijkvoorbeelden. Over leiderschap en leren, betrokkenheid en bevlogenheid, inzetbaarheid en inclusie. Omdat mensen het verschil maken in jouw organisatie. PeoplePower met Glenn van der Burg.
Stop doing education and start doing learning. The truth is we forget the great majority of what we learn. This is a serious problem that has a major bearing on business training programs and the way learning and development is shaped. Are we thinking about learning the wrong way? Don't we all learn in the same way with many small individual variations? Will L&D be able to break through the mold to really start focusing on learning? But where should we start when redefining our L&D strategies? Our guests are Nick Shackleton-Jones. Nick has an impressive career in positions with Siemens, the BBC and Deloitte, and is now CEO and founder of Shackleton Consulting. And he's also the author of How People Learn. And together with me, as always, is Tom Bos, Managing Director of the Consulting Online Academy. How people learn, and together with me, as always, is Tom Bos. That's a bit strange. What is happening with our technical side? Well, so I'll ask Tom. Why did you invite Nick?
Yeah, well, Glenn, the show is usually about lifelong learning. Well, it's actually kind of the name of our podcast.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I read some things about Nick, and I got intrigued because his statement was, I'm not sure, I think I read it in a blog or so, successful organizations eliminate the need for learning, which is kind of contrary to lifelong learning as we propose. So yeah, I thought that'd be a great conversation to have with Nick today.
Wow. Well, let's see if the technical side of our show is already fixed, or else I'll just play a song and then we'll fix that within the song. The technical side, I hear myself in an echo. So I'll just let's just play a song and we'll fix the problem during that song.
People Power met Glenn van der Burg.
Met in the studio via phone, Nick Shackleton-Jones, and of course, also in the studio, Tom Bos. Nick, great to have you in the studio.
Hey, great to be here.
Yeah, well, we were
wow, that was a first.
We were dabbling a bit with the connection. We tried something fancy, but in the end, the phone always works. Nick, you have a very impressive career already for a big part also within learning and development. What's so interesting or so fascinating in the field of learning and development that you decided to spend your part of your life on it?
Wow. Well, I think the opportunity to begin doing learning. I think the reality is that organizations have yet to begin thinking about learning in their organizations. And they might object and say, well, you know, we've been doing it for a long time. But what they've actually been doing is education. And that's something almost completely different. And to sort of illustrate that point, because I appreciate it sounds a bit abstract, I spent a lot of time kind of talking and building different programs. And way back when I was at BP, I ended up talking to lots of leaders about their transition into leadership. And one thing that I heard quite a few of them say is, I think I could do the job if it wasn't for all the people stuff. And I remember thinking, well, what do you mean the people stuff? And these leaders would say things like, oh, you know, all that HR nonsense, you know, performance reviews, succession planning, development planning. Right. And, you know, I got the insight from that was that they think of learning as education, not as something that they can do, not as something that's happening every day through the work that people in their teams are doing or the challenges that they set people, but they think of it as, you know, standing in front of a group of people with a flip chart or building an e-learning module, something which definitely isn't their responsibility. And that's because they're thinking of it as education. I think, well, I'm a leader. I don't know education. That's the HR team, the training team that do that. And so this idea that learning is education, is putting some stuff up on a screen, has almost destroyed the opportunity for us to begin to do real learning within organizations. And it's why so many organizations are struggling with learning culture, is because we're still tending to see it through this educational frame. So yeah, I mean, I can talk about that more if it's interesting, but
okay,
it's such an opportunity.
You know? What you say is, Nick, that the way that we have been taught about what learning is, probably from early childhood onwards to university or all the schools that we've been to, it has destroyed our way of looking at it. That's kind of firm.
Yeah. And it's not a hunch. You know, this is what 70-20-10 was reflecting, and many of the research studies that came after, which is that formal education, you know, the sitting in a classroom, the redoing an e-learning module, is a tiny fraction of the learning that people actually do at work. The vast majority of it, 90% upwards, is through all the challenges that we are setting people and the support that we're giving them. But it's all informal. It's all below the waterline, and we haven't really thought about it in a systematic way in most cases. And that's tremendously damaging, but it also means there's a tremendous kind of opportunity. But look, it's damaging. I've spent a lot of my life running learning teams, and the problem is that people come to them in the expectation that they will just do education, and they will start to complain that they feel like order takers, because what they're being asked to do is content dumping. Somebody will come and say, look, put this new policy in a course. We need this stuff in a module. Get it out to people. And there's this sort of tacit recognition that we know this isn't going to make any impact, just as it made very little impact when we went through school. And we forget the vast majority of it. But, you know, we're going to do it anyway.
Yeah, but the interesting part, Nick, is that in the beginning of your career, you were also a teacher.
Yeah, I was.
And how did you do it then? Because you were a part of the system that is destroying our way of looking and learning.
Yes, I was. I was complicit in this. And that, it irked me even then that there was something deeply wrong with it. So let me give you an example. I used to teach psychology, and as part of that, I would teach learning theory. And so picture this, right? I would be standing up in front of a group of kids, writing on a board, Piaget says that all learning should be exploratory. And they would obediently copy this down, you know, into their books so they could regurgitate it for an exam and forget it immediately thereafter. I mean, what's more ridiculous than that?
Yeah. It's but telling people also, not to smoke while smoking.
Yeah, exactly. But I could also glimpse the edges of something very different, which is that I began to notice that students would get engaged by things which were personally significant. So, you know, I remember one occasion I was teaching psychoactive drugs. It was kind of a hot day, you know, and all of a sudden a student who was normally very quiet perked up and started asking lots of questions around, you know, what would happen if you mixed this with that? And I would be saying, well, that'd be a very bad idea. But it occurred to me then that suddenly they had a personal interest in this topic, and that was what was driving their learning. And this became really the cornerstone of thinking about, you know, the difference between learning and education, because education is indiscriminate. It's content-centric. It just takes a bunch of content, pushes it out to people, and most of it is just shared immediately. But learning is always personal. It's the things that matter to us that drive our learning. And so that became the cornerstone of rethinking, I guess, what learning is and how learning works.
Mm. And is that also then the basis of your book? Because the title, How We Learn, that's so complex. How can you write it down in one book, how everything works around how we learn?
Oh, I can do that. I can do it in a couple of sentences.
Oh, really? Please do. Please do.
Yeah. So I think people assume that How People Learn is going to be one of those books which, like a lot of similar sounding books, just does this quick, you know, layman's summary of current research. It's not that. It introduces a new way of thinking about learning and cognition more generally, which sounds like a big deal, and I think it is. And basically, in a couple of sentences, what learning, how people learn introduces the affective context model, which says that when we experience the world, we encode our reactions to the world, and it's those stored reactions to things that drive changes in our behavior. If you don't have a reaction to some experience, even if that experience is sitting in a classroom with just some information on a board, you won't remember it. When your parents ask you about it, you will say it was boring, which is a way of saying, I didn't have a reaction to any of it. And you won't encode it, and it won't change your behavior. And this is why, when now we look at the application of that to corporate life, there's really only two kinds of things going on. There's stuff that we care about. Like if you join an organization, you desperately want to fit in. And so you will pull all of the content. You'll observe closely what's going on around you because you care about that. But then there's the other kind of thing which is going on where people, they don't care about it. They may not care about safety sufficiently or diversity and inclusion. And there, if we want people to learn, we have to create a reaction. We have to challenge people. And so this fundamental dynamic changes your perspective on learning and what it is. Once you understand that human beings, like all creatures, are just storing the stuff they react to.
Right. Yeah.
So that's it.
Yeah. Well, very simple explanation. I just read my my preparation notes, and I wrote down to ask Nick whether or not he's called the marshmallow guy now.
Yeah.
And that's because of a great example. Yeah. I noticed in your, I think it was a video on YouTube or something. The example of how to. Oh, well, maybe you can elaborate on it yourself. That might be much easier.
It's not because Nick eats a lot of marshmallows.
Maybe it is, but okay. Wasn't the reason.
So, yeah. Nick, why are you called the marshmallow guy?
Well, I mean, it's a lovely illustration of the point I'm trying to make, which is that I've done a number of talks, and one of the things I say early on at the talk is, unless I do something that really gets a reaction from you, the chances are you're going to forget everything I say. And so I say, let's say I start throwing marshmallows at you, and I start throwing marshmallows at the audience. I'm prepared to bet in 2 years that will be what you remember. Oh, the marshmallow guy. And so the point I'm making is that it is our reaction to things that we remember. And if you think back to school, it will be the things that you reacted to. You know, embarrassment is a common one. Being, you know, humiliated by a teacher is another common one. Or some being awarded publicly, receiving a certificate or an award publicly is another one. So we just don't understand this. At a fundamental level, we've fallen into thinking that learning is something that happens when you just dump content on people. But people aren't computers. We don't learn that way.
Yeah, and I what I particularly like about this example with the marshmallow is that it's a terribly simple thing to do, right? So
yeah.
Generally in the neuroscience around learning, there's a lot of discussion about the importance of emotion, which makes perfect sense, obviously. But I think personally that the role of emotion, or like the emphasis that is needed, is much exaggerated. Like you don't need to make people cry or shout out from total happiness or anything. Like the emotion you want to trigger, it can be very subtle or can be very simple and still help people remember.
And in this case, it's something that's out of the ordinary. I think what I've learned is that our brain goes in is in automatic until the moment that something happens that right. It cannot predict.
Yeah.
Like a keynote speaker throwing marshmallows.
Yeah.
And then the brain goes like, what is happening here? I have to pay attention.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, and that might be just the first trigger to your memory, right? So your memory is generally you jump around through things. Like, for example, sometimes I can't remember a name of a person, but then I can remember where I met this person. And when I remember that, I remember his name. Yeah. So the marshmallow guy might just be the entrance towards a secondary memory, which is what Nick was actually talking about in the session.
Yeah. But does it work that way then, Nick? That because you've done something that's out of the ordinary, that's not something people would expect, then also the rest of the content is also better stored, better remembered?
No. To put it, you know, bluntly, the point you made around emotions being much more subtle than people imagine is absolutely true. If I give an illustration, if you think of the sound of a mosquito and then the sound of a bee, you have a distinctly different emotional reaction to those two imaginings. And although you'd struggle to put it into words, that is your experience of those two things. But to answer your point, does it make the rest of the content more memorable? No, you will remember what matters to you, and that's invariant. So the example I sometimes give is if you have two people on a train, and one person is interested in architecture, and the other person is fascinated by plants, they will have, at face value, the same train journey. But the person who's interested in architecture will remember completely different things to the person interested in plants. And this is what I find whenever I give a talk, is that I may say 200 things, and people will come up to me at the end of that talk, but the thing that they remember is the thing that relates to something that really matters to them. Why is that? Well, it's because the things that matter to us govern the things that we have a reaction to. And so what the point of the marshmallow is, there are certain experiences that you can guarantee everybody will react to, right? Some crazy maniac throws marshmallows at you or punches you on the nose in the middle of the street. Everybody will remember that. Nobody will have that happen to them and say, "What, anything happened to you today? Oh, I forgot that somebody punched me on the nose in the street." But then building up from that, what you'll see is that different people, because they care about different things, have a different reaction to information, and this determines what they remember. And this is why you have to understand your audience and what they care about if you're going to begin designing learning. And that's why education is such a monstrous process. You just get a bunch of kids, drag them into a room, say, you know, shut up, sit down, don't care what you care about, don't care if you're interested in dinosaurs, don't even care what your name is, here's the stuff. And this is what's gone wrong.
Right. And then if we look at how traditional learning is within organizations, what's from the things that you just taught us, which we will never forget, by the way, no marshmallows needed. What's going wrong within organizations? Why is learning such a tough nut to crack?
It's a very simple insight, right? Like how you explain it, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Sounds easy to apply, right?
Yeah, it's a very short book.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
So why isn't it picked up?
Yeah, why isn't it picked up? I think it sounds like common sense. If you were doing product development, it would be common sense. You know, people talk about it as design thinking. It's, well, why wouldn't you talk to your customers and find out what matters to them as part of the process of designing your product? And then it seems extraordinary that we don't do that with learning. And instead with learning, what happens is that some senior person comes and says, here's a bunch of content, put it in the course. And you think, well, why on earth would we do that? And the answer is, as I say, in education. But I need to bring it to life for you, because that will still sounds very abstract. But if you're designing an induction program, or design many induction programs, what you'll find is, and this happened in professional services, that people were joining, and senior people had put lots of content in the induction program about strategy and values, and these things are important, right? But what we discovered is that when you actually talk to new starters, what they cared about was things like fitting in. They want to know how to fit in. And we also discovered very practically that they spend a lot of time initially so-called off the clock or on the bench. In other words, it takes them a while to find a project, and they find it incredibly dispiriting and demoralizing, and some of them leave. Mm-hmm. But the induction program didn't prepare them for that because it was too busy talking about the sales cycle and how to work with clients. But if you actually take the time to talk to people as part of the design process, you will understand what they care about, and it will completely transform the design of any program. And that's been true on every program that I've created. It really does make a difference.
Yeah, it sounds like that we start with the one paying our check instead of the one being in our classroom.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of makes sense, right? To listen to that person. But I have a great example of this as well, like something we noticed in the development of Online Academy when producing courses, when we asked teachers or professional developers of courses to develop a course on any theme, let's say programming, they generally deliver a program which starts with the history of. So like the background of programming, which language was first, how did it come to exist, etc., which we noticed when discussing this with our trainees, that is very much not what they were interested in. They started the course because they wanted to learn programming. So what we now do is we flipped it around. We teach them to code in the first 5 minutes of taking the course, booking your first success, and later on explaining like the history of when it makes sense to you, like, oh, I made some progression, and I'm curious now, where did it come from? And then you get into history.
Funny. Yeah, we have here within the studio, we also do workshops, podcasting workshops. And one of the first things we do after we have given them some sandwiches for lunch, and we learned that through time, first we go into the studio with everybody because that's where the magic happens.
Ah, right. Yeah.
And from that moment, everybody has, and then we tell them, in 4 hours, you'll be here behind the microphone doing your first podcast. And from that moment on, everybody is interested, is listening, and because they're also scared as hell because they have to perform in front of the microphone.
Oh, right.
I love that example. I just want to re-emphasize that point you just made there, because I have the opportunity to look at lots of program designs. And if I look through a program design and I cannot see a challenge, people are not being challenged to do something at any point in the program, then I can guarantee no learning is going on. And so many of our programs are just filled, you know, hour after hour with content. No learning is happening. And until you challenge people, you can do it lots of ways. People call it flipped classroom, and we're calling it experience design. But it's those challenges that drive learning in every business. And there are two classes. There are the challenges that people already have in their jobs, where we could help them. We could actually say, look, you, in the example that you gave, you know, here are the things you are struggling to do from a programming perspective. Let us show you how to do these things. Or in the latter example you gave, you can present people with a challenge. You can say, you are going to be podcasting in, you know, 4 hours time, and that drives learning. But it's a really vital point, and I'm glad you made it.
Wow. All right. So looking at individuals that, because I can imagine that there's a big difference between individuals that learn effectively and that don't learn so effectively. What's the difference, you think, Nick?
Well, I'm not sure that I would recognize that distinction. I guess one thing that I do see a lot, because everybody learns, you think about, can you imagine applying that same idea to pets? You know, big difference between dogs that learn effectively and human learning isn't fundamentally different. But what I do see is a lot of people who've been damaged by the educational process, for whom learning has become so closely linked to their self-esteem that they are afraid to try things, and they're afraid to experiment, and they're afraid to operate outside of their comfort zone. So I think that's a very real phenomenon. People for whom learning represents a kind of a risk. And as a consequence, they won't experiment. They won't take on new challenges. And so I think they need more support and more encouragement. And that's why I think some of what I do is focusing on leadership and how leaders kind of coach people and support people and build their confidence.
I think that's a very valid point to make. And it came up quite often in our episodes, I think, before Glenn, the importance of feeling safe and having a great experience in the past with education, which is not common, I guess, or not at least to be assumed that
it's
the case.
I think in almost all our shows that we talk about lifelong learning, this passes by. Like, okay, this is one of the problems that we have, that people associate learning with failure, with something that's not nice, which is terrible.
Yeah. I think it kind of proposes a secondary challenge as well, because a very common theory in learning is also about desirable difficulties. So it's important, as Nick mentioned, to get out of your comfort zone and not necessarily take the easy road. If you had a very bad experience in the past, then you might be constantly avoiding those kind of difficulties, right? So that your focus doesn't become like learning to play the piano or something. It becomes like satisfy the teacher or something like that will be your purpose of doing exercises, which is a much different exercise than, or a much different focus than actually getting better at playing piano and enjoying it.
you mentioned neuroscience earlier, and if people are interested in some of the neuroscience behind this, then Damasio and Damasio's student Mary Helen Imedino Yang have both published really interesting books on the topic. But in relation to comfort zone and stress, there's a guy called Jack Panksepp, who's written a fantastic summary of lots of the research around this. And there's one example that really stood out for me, which is that a lot of rats in their juvenile stage learn through play. But he discovered that if you introduce the smell of a cat into a rat cage, they immediately stop playing. They come out of exploratory mode, as he describes it, immediately, and the baseline rate for exploration and play just drops to zero. And I think it's illustrative of a cross-species phenomenon, which is stress and threats to our well-being in a variety of ways just kill the appetite for kind of learning and play and experimentation, which I think are very closely related.
I think it actually mentally prevents it, right? Because of the threats, like you get to a more deeper function in your brain, switching from cognition to emotion or survival.
And of course, when you're learning, you're doing something that you cannot do already, or you have to talk about something that you do not know already. So it's uncharted territory, and therefore a bit dangerous for us.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, let's skip to helping our listeners, our HR professionals, our L&D professionals. So let's say, Nick, imagine that our listeners are now thinking about everything that they do and also thinking, well, okay, I have some stuff to do because there's not all that much excitement and not that much emotion in my programs. So what would you suggest for them to do? What's the first step?
So first thing to say is it's not about creating excitement or emotion. What's fundamental is understand your audience. That would be the key takeaway. Mm-hmm. Do not do any kind of program design without doing a well-formed audience analysis. Because if you do not know what the people going into your program care about, you have no confidence that you can design experiences or resources that will help them. A very practical example, again, I worked on a leadership program where nobody had figured out that 40% of the senior leaders on this program did not have a team. And yet most of the content was oriented towards managing your team. It's just crazy. So even really simple things like that, talk to the audience. So I developed a process called the 5DI, which is define, discover, design, develop, deploy, and iterate. And although that sounds really incredibly dull, the interesting thing about it is in the discover phase, the second phase, you actually systematically understand your audience, what tasks they're having to do and what they care about. And that will enable you to design two kinds of things. Resources that really help them with the job, with the stuff they care about. You know, so if you're a new starter, a checklist or top 10 mistakes to avoid is a really handy resource. Or if they don't care about things, like they don't care about safety or diversity, the kinds of experiences that will really resonate because they care about other things, like being personally included in decisions and so on. So that's the key message, which is, you know, you have to integrate audience analysis into your design process if you want to have any business impact, if you want to change performance and experience.
Okay, so that's maybe the main thing that L&D professionals tend not to do, to really dive into who is in that classroom or who is my target audience for learning new skills.
Maybe I can simplify a bit to make it much easier to do this. Let me tell you about the approach we take towards getting connected to the audience. We do make an initial analysis of who our user is, or who, since we're fully in e-learning, let's say our learners. But then we just start offering a course, start piloting it, and gather feedback again and again and again and again, and grow the, well, your audience grows, so you get more feedback. That's why feedback's mandatory in our platform. So we learn much more about the general approach or the needs of the learners in the courses, We see where people drop off. We see where people make mistakes generally. We see in the evaluations topics they are missing or they want to have emphasized. So I'm calling it simplifying. Maybe I make it much more difficult, but like you can overanalyze in the start, obviously, and sometimes it might be much easier to just start offering your course and evaluate it as opposed to having years of analysis before starting to offer anything.
Yeah, I like that too. That's an iterative approach, and it works in my experience especially well where you don't quite know how a learning experience is going to land.
Right.
But I would just build on that and say in designing a course, for me, a big shift for L&D teams is to be to say, well, there's no content in the course, which they find shocking. But if there is any content, we're going to put it outside the course. We're going to put it somewhere where people can get it. The course will be end-to-end experiences. I want to see what experience, what challenge will people right. have from 9 to 10? What challenge will people have from 10 to 11? That's how a learning experience is designed.
Yeah, nice.
And people find that a very alien way of thinking because they're so brainwashed into thinking that it will be like your timetable at school, mm-hmm. that we will be doing French and then geography. And then so although it's a simple thing to say, and I think you said earlier, common sense, it's really tough to change that habit that people, I think, have fallen into.
Yeah, but I really like this approach, since when you flip it this way, like the challenge you're up for example, in the programming course, which I mentioned, the challenge of programming a taxi meter, for example, or some simple game or whatever, causes you to understand which things you need to be learning or you want to learn,
yeah.
and then you can fetch the resources which are relevant and skip the others, which makes designing an adaptive course much easier. Because that'd be my question to you, Nick. I also would have an answer, but that's just for myself and my courses. But the complex thing, I think, with the audience is that what we also notice in regular education over here is the differentiation. Like getting everyone what they need means you need to produce maybe 5, maybe 20 times more content than you should regularly need. Like, how would you deal with that, like the satisfying everyone's need?
Yeah, it's a common question. I think that there are two answers to that. So in practice, in business, you create personalization through resources, because that's the beauty of Google, right? Google is a wonderfully personalized experience because it's just a bunch of resources and you pull the bits that you need as you need them. So this kind of mantra mm-hmm. that I introduced, which is not the whole story, by the way, but, you know, resources, not courses, illustrates that if you actually build useful stuff for people, they will pull the bits they need, and by its very nature, that will be personalized. Mm-hmm. But the other answer to your question, which is a really good challenge, is do your audience analysis and then do core and elective design structure. So if you're taking New Starts as an example, probably if you talk to your audience, you'll find that every single New Start struggles with the fear of kind of being accepted and fitting in. Mm-hmm. So that can be part of your core content. But then you'll develop different personas. You'll discover that some are more experienced, some understand business, you know, some have particular challenges in their part of the business. And then you can build electives. And their pathway, if you like, will be comprised of much more personalized content because it will be kind of core and elective in structure. Mm-hmm. But how do you solve that problem? You know, I think you said you had a different approach.
Yeah, well, I think it's quite similar, but the general approach for us is based on learning a lot from a lot of people. So like it's a continuous iterative process. So we try to learn in hindsight, so to speak. So we start with a very small analysis, target group analysis, like as you would do in marketing, for example, right? Create some personas, figure out who's generally speaking in your course. And then now, well, with current technology, you can take a much bigger step in personalizing content based on your behavior in the platform and all evaluations which we see. So we do general improvements and very specific improvements to personalize content. The hard answer is it takes a lot of work. Like adaptive, creating adaptive courses, for example, on, well, let's stick with programming, for example, is it's kind of complicated. So it just takes a lot of time and energy, but I think it's very much worth it.
But I think that it's interesting what you said, Tom, about marketing, because I think we, when creating a course or creating a leadership program or, well, all the stuff that we do in learning and development, I think we tend to forget that there is an audience.
Yeah.
They don't buy a ticket, but they give us our time.
Right.
A lot of their time.
Yeah.
So if you would more think like a marketeer instead of, what's the goal of the... of the leadership program, okay, what kind of skills do we have to learn them?
Right.
Maybe that would help, Nick. How do you see that?
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think there's a lot of victim blaming that happens in L&D. And generally, whenever somebody talks about learning culture, it's a victim blaming conversation. What I mean by that is that people say they haven't got time to learn. Well, what they actually mean is that they haven't got time for all of the irrelevant educational stuff that we are trying to force down their throats. And generally what happens is a big organization will buy a big library of content, and then they'll see very little usage of that content. And then instead of saying, well, maybe we've done something wrong, like maybe we didn't actually take time to understand whether this content would help people with the challenges they have, maybe we're just trying to force it at people. Instead of saying that, they say, well, there's something wrong with our learners. Yeah. They're not consuming all this content, right? Why aren't you consuming all this content? There's something wrong with you. And then they will say learning culture or self-directed learning or lack of ownership.
Right.
And they'll point to the fact that people say they don't have time. It's rubbish. Mm. Who said they don't have time to Google? Who ever said, I don't have time to Google? People are learning every day, and it is their job that is driving their learning. Mm-hmm. But if we just try and force irrelevant in the way that education does, irrelevant content at people, and they say they don't have time for that, but it's not necessarily their problem.
Yeah, it would
so
be
I
the same.
I agree that marketing approach is
it would be the same as a marketeer at McDonald's would say, well, yeah, these consumers, they're really stupid. They don't eat our stuff.
Right.
I mean, they're really stupid. It's their fault.
I mean,
nobody would say that.
The shop is empty, right?
But it
surprises you, like in how many cases that becomes like the primary metric for success, like how much usage is there of certain courses, for example, which gives you an indication of what resonates with two people, right? Like if for example, the general content library can be opened and if there's no rules like who can do what or who should do what, then it makes perfect sense to look at those numbers and see like what resonated with people, where are people's interests. But it's like it's not really a metric for the success of learning in your organization, nor is it a qualification of your the quality of your learning organization.
Yeah. Nick,
yeah.
I want to also look a bit at the future and your hopes for the future. So looking like, let's say, 5 years ahead, what would you hope learning within an organization will look like?
Can we take one step back?
Oh, you want to take a step back.
No. Yeah. we'll get to this question. But since you have a great track record in corporate learning, I was wondering, like, how did you progress through that time? In terms of improving learning in those organizations, like what did you do? And then maybe you can step towards the future.
Yeah, I've been annoying for a very long time, I'm afraid. I think I wouldn't recommend it. I think nothing worth doing is easy. I had a colleague, you know, who said something similar at BP and said anything worth doing is worth handing a badge in. And there aren't a lot of rewards, really, frankly, I think, for people seeking, I think, to push things on. Mm-hmm. So I think I'll try and answer the question simply. I think I've learned to be more diplomatic. I've learned to listen more and to really kind of connect with the business need, because that's really helpful. If you say, let's just set aside talking about learning objectives and focus on what does the business really need, I think that's a common ground for mm-hmm. progress. But I think the other thing that we're all talking about learning on this call, right? And the people listening to this are interested in learning. So that's all fine, because we're learning geeks, and I love that. But generally the business, they're not that interested in all this learning nonsense. They don't want to hear our complicated arguments. So show not say is what I was saying to the teams at Deloitte. show people a better alternative. Mm-hmm. Don't try and get buy-in from the business to change through the kinds of conversation we're having here. Just show them something which is a radically and obviously kind of better way of doing things. And that's where you'll get buy-in. So show, not say, was one of my kind of mantras.
Oh, right. Yeah, that sounds great. And that's also a really great way to keep business from actually interfering with your nerdy ideas on what learning is all about, right? So like everyone should be doing their own job in that sense. Like if you help the business solve their problems and you show that you have helped them, I don't think they couldn't care less like whether or not you did that with a very fancy learning program or something very simple or e-learning or classroom or whatever. That's not what interests them. But if you ask them, like, what do you think we should do, then definitely they will have some idea. And that might be a very traditional approach since they were successful in regular education, for example.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always feel it's important to bring these things to life. So, simple example, when I was working at BP, we had this knowledge expert who was an expert in sand management. He was going to leave the organization, and the organization said, Nick, sand management, yeah, okay. It's a real thing. They said, look, can you capture all his knowledge? And when we met with the expert, he was delivering very conventional education, 8-hour lectures, and I think he thought we were going to film an 8-hour lecture and put it online somewhere. But instead of doing that, we said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to talk to all of the people who've been in your program the last year and ask them what their questions are, and then we're going to have like the top 100, and then you're going to get 5 minutes on each. And so instead of building some monstrous 8-hour knowledge dumping course, we converted it into 100 short resources that answered the questions that people had. Right. So when you can show that to somebody in the business and say, wouldn't that be a better way to tackle that? They will immediately say, yeah, I can see that would be a much better way to do it. And then you don't have to have the big debate.
Nice.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Great example. Mm. Okay. Are we ready to go into the future now? Back to the future. Back to the future.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Nick, 5 years from now, you can prophesy a bit. What do you hope learning will look like within organizations?
Well, I love thinking about the future. I think there is... It's an existential crisis for L&D, frankly, because I think we're a bit like an internal pizza shop. So we keep shipping out more content and people are consuming it, but nobody can answer the question, you know, is it doing anybody any good? Mm-hmm. And I think there's a real risk that, as we've seen with companies like ByteDance and TikTok, that the game is up. Somebody just says, actually, hang on, this isn't making any difference. So I hope that we will save ourselves in L&D. And I think that there are two routes for doing that. One is through creating helpful stuff, because people are finding work challenging and businesses want more productivity. So creating useful stuff, resources that just provide performance support, is something that we can really do that has a big impact. And I'm not the first person to say this. You know, performance support, people like Kathy Moore in the US, you know, it's a really good approach to actually making it easier for people to do their jobs. The other thing that we can do is challenge people. And we can do that in lots of interesting ways, but through creating experiences, either that we run as L&D or experiences that are toolkits that leaders use to build and create challenges that drive learning, you know, within their organizations. So in sum, shifting away from education and starting to do kind of learning and performance support is what I would hope. But not for anybody else's sake, just because I care about us as learning professionals, and I would like us to continue to make more of a difference, I guess, and to continue to exist.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of work to do because the world is still changing quite fast. Last question for me. I'm looking at Tom if he has one.
Oh, go ahead.
Burning question. The fire engine question. No fire engine question. Okay. Many. So last question for me. A good practical tip for our listeners that they can implement tomorrow without having to clear their whole schedule?
Blimey, yes. I think, yeah, I guess it would either be design, you know, look at the challenges in programs or do your audience analysis. I'm only hesitating because people might think, well, that's all very well, Nick, but how the heck do I do that? And I'm also hesitating because I don't want to do blatant self-promotion, but I'm going to dip a toe in the water. No, not even read the book.
Okay.
I don't make it. There's a bunch of free stuff on ShackletonConsulting.com, like guidance on how to do that, on how to do audience analysis, on how to design learning experiences. So if people are interested in that kind of thing, then that would be my advice. You know, create challenging experiences for people if you're designing an event, but always do your audience analysis. Those would be two things. And if people need to know how to do that, then the content is out there.
Super.
Right.
It was a pleasure. Wasn't it, Tom?
Yeah.
It definitely was. Yeah. Great start of the show, by the way. So
yeah. I learned a lot already.
That's the first. Yeah. So that was nice. But I really love the conversation. So thanks a lot, Nick.
Thanks.
Thank you both.
Nick Shackleton-Jones. We'll make sure that we put all the links to Nick's website and also to his book, of course, in the show notes. And thanks to you also, Tom Bos,
for being here
as always. And thanks to you, of course, for listening to our show.
Meer afleveringen vind je op peoplepower.radio en jouw favoriete podcast app.